Nachiyomi for the Orthodox Union, Sefer Shoftim, the Book of Judges, Perek Yud Zayin, Chapter 17, Rabbi Binny Marilis. As mentioned previously, that when we hit Chapter 17, the Book of Shoftim takes a turn, moving away from the history of the life and times of the varying judges, to detail two very unfortunate events. The events, first off, of Pesel Micha, the idol, the graven image of Micha. That's in 17 and 18. And then 19, 20, and 21 is the Pilegish Begiva, the story of the concubine in Giva. And there are essentially two things to deal with at the outset. One is when these events occur. And by virtue of when these events occur, perhaps a discussion about their location in the story. A quick perusal of the commentaries, and one grasps that these two stories perhaps take place at a different era. Rashi writes as follows. Even though these two stories, the first one, which is the one we begin with in Perek Yud Zayin, and the second one that begins in chapter 19, written at the end of the Sefer, Betchilas HaShoftim Haya, they took place in actuality at the beginning of the period of the judges, Bimei Otniel ben Kenaz, in the time of Otniel ben Kenaz. Meaning that they're written after Shimshon, which is some 300 and some odd years after the life and times of Otniel ben Kenaz. And if one simply would read the stories, one would simply assume that in the aftermath of the death of Shimshon, these two events take place, just prior to the onset of Shmuel HaNavi and Eli HaKohen and David HaMelech, and Shaul HaMelech, these two very unfortunate and very sad events. On the other hand, if they took place many centuries ago, they happened before even the first of the Shoftim arrives on the scene, so then you have to ask a question as to, okay, what was going on then, and then why are they listed here? So perhaps as to what was going on then is the notion that in the period of time post-Yehoshua leading up to Otniel ben Kenaz, essentially there was no specific leadership per se in the Jewish community. And V'isha Yeshab Enavtas said that people simply acted according to their own vision of righteousness. And nobody was sort of serving as an audit committee, as an oversight with jurisdiction in legislating these situations. In such a situation, unfortunately, many things can happen. And what we see in these two stories is two very unfortunate things happen, one relating to Micha and one relating to the Pilegesh. And at the same time, perhaps, the listing of them at the end of the story, at the end of the book, is perhaps more thematic than chronological. Thematic in the sense that some of the text lines that Shmuel HaNavi, the author of our Sefer, uses is that there's no king, Ein Melech, there's no king at this time. The implication perhaps being that if there was a centralized power, if in fact there was a centralized region, then maybe this stuff wouldn't happen. And that it sort of serves Shmuel thematically leading into the book later on, the next Sefer, where we even do get to the concept of a melech, that there has to be a certain righteousness in the population for a melech, and that there has to be a certain status that is reached, a certain place spiritually for the king concept to take heed and to take root and to work. And Shmuel is essentially preaching a similar message that he's been preaching throughout the book. It essentially requires a sort of Jewish people that are committed and connected to Torah and mitzvos in a way that they, unfortunately, at this point are not. And therefore they suffer, and therefore these tragedies, in fact, do occur. So chapter 17, Perek Yud Zayin, really is the setup for the tragedy, which takes place in chapter 18. And it's an odd tragedy, but we'll see that tomorrow. And then 19, 20, and 21 describes a more obvious event with respect to the Pilegesh. And we'll get to it when, in fact, we get to it. Now, Perek Yud Zayin. There was a man from Ephraim, and his name was Michaihu. His name will get shortened in the course of our discussions, and we'll explain why that is, when in fact that does occur. Vayomer li'imo, he says to his mother, Elef umei hakesef ashilu kach lach, the 1,100 pieces of silver that were taken from you, vi'at Alit, v'gam amart be'oznai, that you have cursed the person who stole it, and you have uttered that curse and spoken that curse even into my own ears. Perhaps, as some of the commentaries explain, that she has an inkling that he is the ganav, the thief, or perhaps simply that she speaks it out loud, that her son should hear a curse with respect to somebody who would steal such an item. He says, "Hine hakesef iti ani lekachtiv." He says, the money is with me, I took it. He admits that he stole his mother's money. Vatomer imo. And his mother says to him, Baruch b'ni l'Adonai. Blessed are you, my son, to Hashem. The Metzudas David explains, what does that mean? Ritzolomar haklalos shekalalti lo yacholu bach. Becha, the curses that I uttered should not ascribe to you, ach baruch tihyeh ho'il v'hodisa, but rather you should be blessed by virtue of the fact that you have admitted guilt. So here it is, the child stole money from his mother to the tune of 1,100 pieces of silver. She curses the thief. He admits that he is the one, and now he's giving back the money to her. At the beginning of verse 3, he returns the money to his mother. Vatomer imo, the mother says to him, Hakdesh hikdashti es hakesef ladunai miyadi livni lasot pesel umasecha. She says to him as follows, I have sanctified that money to God, given over from my hand miyadi livni to my son, i.e. you, Lasos pesel umasecha, to make a carved image and a molten image. A pesel would be a carved image, an idol, classic idol, statue type of thing. Umasecha would be a molten image. Vata ashivenuach, and now we'll give it back to you. So they're having this sort of back and forth over this money. He stole it, she consecrated it, and she's giving it back to him to make something of an idol worship out of it. So it's sort of a twisted irony that's going on here. The son's a thief. The mother is sanctifying monies for what one would call non-God-related activities. God-related meaning God of the Jews related, but rather for the sake of some sort of an idol situation to be set up and established. So what does the son do? He's in a bind. His mother wants him to build or to create a pesel with her money. What do you do? Vayashev es hakesef l'imo. He returns the money to his mother. Suddenly he's righteous. Didn't he just steal money from her? Yes, he stole money from her, but now that he's acknowledged his guilt, so he's returning the money to her, and he doesn't want any part of her idol-worshipping activities. So the mother takes the money and does with it what she wants to do with it. She finds somebody else to do it. The mother takes 200 of the money. And she gives it to a smith, and he in turn performs the task that she desires. And now the idol is in his house, in Micha's house. So there's a lot of very odd confusion going on here. So he wouldn't do it himself. He wouldn't pay for it himself. He wouldn't take the money to do it himself. But now that the mother has had it paid for and commissioned the activity, now the pesel exists and rests in his home. And now you notice in the next verse his name changes. V'ha'ish Micha, lo beis Elohim. The man Micha, his name is now shortened. He's lost the hey, the yud vav, the shem Hashem from his name, as it were, because now he's sort of involved in idol worship. Now he has a beis Elohim. Beis Elohim is not a place of worship for God, but rather a place of worship for idols. Hayas eifodus srafim, and he makes an ephod and icons, other sort of icons. Trafim is famous from Rachel Imenu. Yad echad mibanav, and then he literally fills up the hands of one of his children, but rather he installs one of his children in a certain role. Vahilo le kohen, and his son becomes his priest. So now you have this following construct. You have a grandson who's serving as the role of a priest in the idol-worshipping house established by his father from the monies of the grandmother who had idols commissioned. How is this all going on? What is going on here? So the next verse, verse 6, seems as a parenthetical statement, but perhaps is revelational or revelatory as it relates to the rest of the story. In those days there was no king in the Jewish people. They did what they wanted to do. They could do what they wanted. There was no consequences to activity. They would do whatever it is that they felt. The Radak writes, Amar Zeh, the Navi writes this, Lefi she'asa Micha ha-pesel, Micha makes the pesel, V'lo ha-yamisha yimcha b'yado, and there was no one who would stand up against him. Ki ein melech v'shofet b'yamim ha-heim. So he adds that word, no melech, no shofet in his day. There's no one there, there's no one in charge, there's no leadership. So perhaps Micha didn't think what he did in fact was wrong, that maybe he's creating a situation that we've seen before, where he's worshipping in partnership God and some other idol, and that this is not so bad, right? This is some sort of a construct that maybe works for him and other people, and there's no one to tell him no. And perhaps that's why this is located here. And the story continues. A surprise Levi arrives on the scene. And a young man from Beit Lechem, from the tribe of Yehuda, from the family of Yehuda, who was a Levi, who Garsham. And he lived there. He lived where? He lived initially in Beit Lechem Yehuda, but now he seems to be on the move. He's going somewhere else. What you have here is a Levi who's from the tribe of Levi, whose mother's from the tribe of Yehuda, and he sits at the tribe of Yehuda. Who this person is, so we'll see coming up at the end. To give you a little bit of a taste of it, many of the commentaries note that this person is the grandson of Moshe Rabbeinu. And we'll see how that fits in and the unfortunate, very sad nature of that possibility. So here you have this person, and he's on the move. And this person, this man, this person from Beis Lechem Yehuda, this Levi, leaves there lagur ba'asher yimtza, to go live where he could find what he could find. What that means essentially is that he could find a place that would sustain him, that he could financially be successful and live a decent life. And he's on his way, and he comes past the crossroads of the house of Michal Asostako to make his way, to go on his path, to go on where he needed to go. As a side point, being a Levi meant that you were reliant on the population to provide you with sustenance. By virtue of the fact that you didn't have your own lands to mine and to work, you rested on the laurels of the success of the other tribes. And being a Levi in those cities meant that if those cities had successful years, then you as a Levi were successful. If you were more of a charismatic Levi and more of a personality, more of a leader in the community, perhaps you benefited more by the relationships that you created. To the degree by which it was possible that certain Levim were not able to sustain themselves where they were located and felt the need to move. And here you find one of these disaffected Levim on the move, and he comes upon Micha. So here you have this Levi who essentially has nothing. He's looking for his way, he's looking for his place. He falls upon this guy, Micha, who lives in Har Ephraim, who has this house of worship that's now being led by his son, who is essentially an apprentice priest without a master. And they meet each other. Vayomer lo Micha. Micha says to him, Me'ayin tavo? Where are you coming from? Vayomer lav. He says back, Levi anochi. I am a Levi. Mi beis lechem Yehuda. From the city beis lechem in Yehuda. Vanochi holeich lagur ba'asher emtza. And I'm going to find where I can live suitably. I'm on my way. Vayomer lo Micha. Micha says to him, Shva imadi. Stay with me. Live with me. Be here. Be with me. Not only that, v'heyeli la'av u'l'kohen, and be for me a father and a priest. Lead me. V'anochi atin l'cha aseres kesef li'yamim. And I will give you 10 pieces of silver for a period of time. Perhaps yamim means a year, as some of the commentaries understand. V'erech begadim. And I'll provide you with clothing and a livelihood. And the Levi went. Did the Levi go in? Did the Levi leave? So that is a disagreement amongst the commentaries. The Malbim is of the opinion that he does not initially accept the offer, but returns later to accept the offer. And other commentaries say, no, immediately upon having the offer, he accepts and immediately takes upon this role. The difference being that if it's the first one where he does not initially accept, that perhaps the person has more of a conscience and he is not willing to accept such a role. Later on then giving in to his need for sustenance. If it's the second one, then perhaps the person doesn't have that same level of conscience and is not concerned about being a role, being a player in such a situation, and simply is out for their own financial benefit. Either way, ultimately, this person, this Levi from Beis Lechem Yehuda, will accept this role. So here you have Micha being somewhat magnanimous and somewhat of a very righteous person. He's offering shelter. He's offering livelihood. Tachnas as Orchim, right? It's the greatest sense of tzedakah that he could give to offer. He's giving him a job. He's giving him a livelihood. He's giving him an opportunity to sustain himself. At the same time, he's doing that in a house of idol worship. Vayoel ha-Levi l'sheves es ha-ish, the Levi accepts. Vayi ha-nar lo ke'echad mi-banav. And the lad, the child, becomes like one of his own sons. That perhaps can be understood in one of two ways. That the child, meaning Micha's child, who was established as the Kohen, becomes like a son to the Levi. Or that the Levi himself becomes like a son to Micha. Perhaps based on the text, it would be the first way, that the child became one like his own son. Micha fills up the hand of the Levi, i.e., essentially, he sustains him, he makes him fulfill his role. And he remains there. and they stay there. So now you have Micha, you have the child, you have the Levi, you have his mother's money, and you have the idol. Vayomer Micha. Now listen to what Micha pulls out of this event. And it's amazing that perhaps if we take Micha to be righteous, that he's essentially a righteous fool, per se, for lack of any other better way of saying it. Vayomer Micha, in verse Yud Gimel, verse 13, Atah yadati, now I know, ki yetiv Adonai li, that God will make it good for me, ki hayali halevi lechohen, for the Levi has become my priest. What a bizarre statement. Essentially what Micha is saying is that he looks at the totality of the situation, and he sees all the success that this has now brought him, essentially. He has his own little, quote-unquote, Beis HaMikdash in his home. And he views this as a positive. He views this as the Yad Hashem, the hand of God, informing him that what he's done is righteous and good, and that everything will work out in the end for good. I say that he's sort of a righteous fool because it's the most bizarre construct that one can imagine. As we mentioned numerous times, you have a child who is by no means worthy of being a priest, acting as a priest. You have a Levi who is a traveler, essentially, who now is establishing himself as a religious leader in the community. You have Micha, who's funding the entire event. You have the grandmother, well, let's actually scratch that. It's Micha who's housing the entire event, who's now paying the employees, i.e. the Levi. And you have the mother who provided all of the financial wherewithal to establish this whole situation. And Micha says that now he knows that God is going to make him successful. One can understand why the statement mentioned before, that was sort of parenthetic. Ein melech v'Yisrael isha yeshab einav ta'aseh, that everyone would do what he thought was righteous in his eyes. What people sometimes think is righteous is not in fact righteous. And on occasion, when people actually think what they're doing is good and is upstanding and is proper and appropriate behavior, in fact, it's ill-informed and misguided. And that perhaps the person simply doesn't know what they're talking about and doesn't have a clue where it is that they have strayed or erred or made a mistake. And Micha is clearly in that class. Perhaps he's not completely, you know, at fault or to blame by virtue of the fact that there is no leadership at hand to teach him and lead him on the right path in the right direction. We continue tomorrow with the rest of the story in chapter 18.